Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Alan Zabrowski on the show. Alan Zabrowski, PhD from the University of Michigan, is a writer and a consultant specializing in national and international security affairs, a Marine Corps Vietnam veteran, and a 1986 graduate of the U.S. Army War College. Dr. Zabrowski teaches in Dr. Zabrowski's teaching and research appointments have included the United States Military Academy, the Center for Strategic International Studies, the Foreign Policy Research Institute, Middlebury College, and Catholic University. While in government service, he held concurrent adjunct professorships at Georgetown University and Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Dr. Zabrowski has lectured widely on defense and foreign affairs in the United States and abroad. His published works include 13 books or monographs and over 160 articles, chapters, and book reviews, which he's adding to this day, from what I understand. Among his books are Alliances in U.S. Foreign Policy, The Recourse to War, An Appraisal of the Weinberger Doctrine, and Prisoners of War, Nation States in the Modern Era. Dr. Zabrowski, how are you doing this evening?
I am doing relatively well. Thank you very much, Timothy.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm not having on to talk about foreign policy or international intrigue or geostrategic issues, geopolitical issues, although I think it might be related to that because it will come up. You penned a recent article that was rather provocative. tonight we're taking on the WQ, the woman question. The title, good title. Feminine Dystopia, From Mystique to Monster. Of course, a lot of people are familiar with The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan. apparently the book that started it all, but I think there's more history to that, back in the 60s, modern feminism. I think that was second wave feminism, if I had that correct, right?
It actually was, although considering Betty Friedan's appearance, I'm surprised that she has something called The Feminine Mystique. The only thing, she would be closer to the monster than the mystique, I think.
Yes, we have a neurotic, crazy, rich bored housewife prescribing to the country what the relationship between men and women should be and the role of women in society. I think she was also on medication at the time she was writing that.
Heavily.
Yeah, so that's great. Isn't that just great? We have the these people prescribing to us how we should all live. So this article, you question the wisdom of the I think the direct participation of women in politics, not just voting, but also in politics, the prominence of female political leadership or management, if you will. I don't know if they lead anything any of these days. You're just kind of they're sock puppets for the oligarchs. But you pen this article questioning the wisdom of women directly involved in politics and executing or practicing political power. This is something that's completely, I think, at odds with progressive or modern thought. After all, everyone's equal, even men and women. So why not? And women actually, not only are they equal, they're more than equal. They're better at politics, depending who you talk to. But I'll let you take it from there.
Well, you know, one of the things that occurred to me and that I mentioned at the beginning of it, that I felt very, very strange writing the article at all. And not really because I've had feminist death threats ever since. No, that's a joke, by the way. But I've lost some friends actually on it. But it was that, you know, today, after the recent decades, men in the West, white men in particular, have become less masculine and more effeminate in generally. And that most of my heroes today are actually women. It's very hard for me to think of a lot of very strong, prominent males these days, you know, under the age of 40. There's a few out there, but not really very many. And when I looked around the political landscape, you know, the people who came up as strong, you know, 30s to 50s in group like that, people like Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, Tulsi Gabbard, Marine Le Pen in France, and I'm not going to pronounce the names because I would mispronounce them, but the current prime minister of Italy, who basically told the woke people to take a walk, that she was getting rid of all lesbian names on birth certificates, that her role was to endorse and promote God, country, and family. The woman who's the head of Alternative für Deutschland, the second largest party in Germany. It actually runs the state governments, I think, of three of the lands of the states in Germany, now all three in East, what was once East Germany, a woman also. Little bit hard to find men doing that when you look at men in leadership positions. The Republicans may have a little bit more than the Democrats, but they're all completely enthralled to the Jewish lobby in America, and I say that as someone who is Jewish on his father's side. They're not really independent, and perhaps none of them can be. But when I looked at this, that was the tip of an iceberg. The bulk of the iceberg has been, in practical terms, ruinous for the institutions of the West. And as the economic independence and the political activism of women in the West has increased, the cohesion of all of the institutions of the West has fragmented. It's almost a perfect correlation. Now, the thing that I discussed with some of my friends, some of the female friends who will still talk to me anyway, the very few of them, both of them standing inside a telephone booth, is that at the same time, younger women, women in general, but younger women in particular, were the object of very extensive and very aggressive propaganda campaign in the media, the entertainment media, in the advertising agencies. There are five advertising conglomerates in the West, all Jewish owned, three in the US, one each in Britain and France, all pushing the same message. Basically, stay away from white men, go with black or brown men, whites are bad, you can be good, but you're basically a vessel for the production of mixed race children in the future. That's the message. And women are, whether they like to admit this or not, women are more impressionable. Young women in particular are more impressionable and more gullible than young men. We have our faults. I did when I was a young man, and I admit it. But our faults are mostly with women. And women's faults are being impressionable about everything else. And they were both simultaneously coming into power and prominence and the target of this propaganda campaign, and they collapsed. And the best evidence we have for that is that as catastrophic as the Democrat policies are, women under 30, unmarried, college age, broke at least 7-3 in favor of the Democrats. And when you get into the 20s, it's 8-2 in favor of the Democrats. And I have no doubt that the next generation will be at least that much or more so. That's catastrophic. And in Europe, the all-female governments in countries like Finland and Sweden were absolute disasters, pushing the same woke agenda as in the United States, pushing every policy that is utterly alien to traditional women, but what they were told was now what they should support, and they did. And it was a disaster. It's been an absolute disaster. I mean, there's absolutely no reason, looking at this, why women in general couldn't be the head of corporations, the head of real estate agencies, anything except the ones that I named there at the end of the article: government, politics, higher education, and the military. These are the ones that have been traditional male enclaves, and if they're not traditional male enclaves, they're going to collapse. And the rest of the world understands this. I can tell you the one proof of this, you get 100 women together, you know, alpha women, who want to be in charge of whatever profession they're in, and ask them how many of them want to work for other women. And I doubt if you'll find one. They know. They know. I just said it.
Well, it's funny because, not funny, haha, but funny in an interesting way, is that I think we were told, I think the how it was sold was that by extending the franchise to women with the 19th Amendment, that it would improve politics. It was part of the progressive reform era, I guess you could say, and
Sure.
that it would add a more humane, a more moral impact, have a more moral impact on electoral politics and their direct participation in politics. As you can look at this, I guess all the measurements we use for, for well-being, societal cohesion, public health, that hasn't been the case, of course. There's been a degrading in the culture and the quality of political leadership, even the fiscal health of the government and of the country, more debt. And so now, whether or not correlation is causation, there's a lot of other things going on there. Can't blame women just for this, of course. As you mentioned, a lot of weak men out there. And I think it all started with a weak man agreeing to bite the apple, right? Supposedly.
Actually, without intending to be humorous, because I'm not on this issue, the 18th Amendment prohibition was considered the capstone of the original feminist movement. The suffragettes were also temperance, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and they were pushing very strongly for prohibition, and they got it. And the following year, they got the vote, and I said somewhat sarcastically to a couple of female friends of mine, that just shows what the DTs can do to men. That coming off the bottle, they thought that giving the vote to women would be a good idea, and that was actually flippant, but I'm not sure it was entirely false. But what I mentioned in the article, just and it wasn't intended to be a major point, but several people have noted it, is that it really became apparent very quickly in the early 20s, 1920s, that prohibition was a disaster in several ways. First of all, it didn't work. Second, it taught Americans in general and men in particular to be lawbreakers, that they found a way to evade the law. But most importantly, and not feel guilty about it. If they wanted to drink after working 8 to 10 hours in a mine or a factory, God damn it, they wanted a drink. That was period. That was the end of it. And worst of all, it gave organized crime its first real foothold in America because it was on an issue that that Americans, particularly American men, disagreed with in terms of government policy. But once, even when that became apparent, the women doubled down and they delayed the repeal of prohibition until 1933, a decade after it was obvious it wasn't working. And that was it. It's just sort of like when you feel it, you're wrong, when you think it's wrong, the best thing to do is to admit your mistake and say, okay, I screwed up. I thought it was a good idea. It wasn't. Let's stop it. Let's change it. I mean, that's what you and I would probably do. It's like men would having a dispute would do. If you and I had an argument, for example, or any two men had an argument, we would do one of two things. We would talk it out or we would fight it out. And when it was over, we'd probably have a drink together and get on with our lives. Women will brood on these goddamn things for decades. They will. I heard that the first time.
As in
You know,
home,
I
as
don't
in
I don't I
politics,
don't I don't I don't listen to religious radio. I just really don't. I'm not that kind. But I was driving back from Pennsylvania, from Pittsburgh to Mississippi, where I live now, and I'm not a native Mississippian. Well, I guess after 28 years here, I guess I'm converted Mississippian, and I'm originally from Michigan. As I told people when I got down here, South Michigan, and everybody laughed and bought me a drink. But I was driving on Interstate 40 about halfway between Nashville and Memphis. And I happened to pick up a broadcast by a Baptist minister, self-identified, and I don't know where his church was or where his broadcast was. And he was talking about having just officiated at the funeral of one of his parishioners. And one of the other parishioners, a woman in her 70s, and one of the other parishioners, also a woman in her 70s, came up and she said, "You know, I remember back in second grade," this minister said, "That woman had been harboring a grudge for nearly 65 years. And had, I mean, really, and it's not uncommon. It is not uncommon. I made the comment that, you know, I think that most men, in my experience, and at 81 years of age, I've had a little bit of experience, most men find women lovable but not likable. That there are very few likable feminine traits. I'm a little strange on that. I do like women. I find, I mean, what are their more difficult traits? I find challenges. But the fact that I like women, I've had a couple of people think I'm homosexual, a couple of men think I'm homosexual, and made passes at me because it was obvious that I liked women. I disabused them of that notion very sharply. you know, it's one of the things that 10 years in the Marine Corps gives you the ability to do, you know, abrupt disabusement to come, you know, comes with the territory. But I mean, most men, I think most men feel that way. They won't tell women that. I mean, a man will never tell a woman, you know, "I love you, but I don't like you." Not at all.
Well, that
not
reminds me of the Simpsons, where Homer had a friend who was a homosexual, and Marge is trying to brick it to him that his friend was a homosexual, and Marge says, and Homer is refusing to admit it, and she says, "Homer, he prefers the company of men," and Homer goes, "Who doesn't?"
I missed that. but I mean, that's true. There's, you know, the word association, you know, one word association is one of those techniques. I learned as a student of psychology, when I did my PhD at Michigan after the Marines, Michigan was still then a very good university. It's got some good aspects of it now, but it's gone woke like most of the other.
Well, Michigan itself was a gynarchy, right? A gynarchic tyranny with the
Very much on it. But at that time in the early 70s, they were very big on interdisciplinary studies. So when I did my PhD, I did a major field. It happened to be in international relations and a cognate field in political science. I did another and a minor field in political science, rather. I did a cognate in history. And I did effectively a master's degree without thesis in psychology and economics. And the people in the other departments would have done the same things. The idea at Michigan was the broader your education in graduate school, the better you'll be in the area of your concentration. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the psychologists were teaching at that time, and it's really a fairly good thing, you know, is word association. You know, think of a word to describe something. And I used that in the early 80s in Washington, when the whole question of women in the military was being discussed. First of all, I asked the unmentionable, there was a meeting at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I said, "Well, what are the military advantages to women in the armed forces?" Dead silence.
You think that'd be the first question, right?
Yeah, I mean, you would have thought I would have crapped on the table, because there weren't any.
Yes.
There were none, exactly none. And then I said, "Well, okay, now what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of men in combat?" And well, the word that came to my mind was brutal. Mm-hmm. War is brutal. Vietnam was brutal. It was really brutal. But that's generally what it is when you think of men in war. And then I thought, well, what word would I use for women in war? It's cruel.
Yeah.
Women are the ones historically in every culture on this earth, and I mentioned that, you know, from the Chinese to the Cherokees to the Celts, all across the world, the women were the one who tortured prisoners and cut up the enemy wounded. You know, there was that famous poem by Rudyard Kipling, which included, "When you, and
Yeah.
when you lie wounded on Afghanistan's plains, and the women come out to cut up your remains, just roll to your gun and blow out your brains and go to your God like a soldier." And it's that women traditionally butchered the wounded, tortured the prisoners, every culture around. Sometimes the men did it too, but that wasn't their primary role. Their primary role was fighting and hunting. The women's primary role was cooking and torturing. And I just really.
Yeah, it would be after hostilities had ceased, when the person is helpless.
After they had ceased. But that was it. And when women actually fought, there was one of these little quips that someone said, the very worst thing an enemy could do would be to threaten Roman soldiers with their women, because they knew what the women would do, and that just made the soldiers fight harder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty true. I mean, but the really sad thing about it, is that there is no way that women have been able to participate in formerly male-dominated professions without relying on preference, male deference, and male protection when needed. That has never changed. They do it now. They did it in the past. They just don't do it as openly now. If a man and woman go out and get drunk together and have sex together, it's the man's responsibility. It's the man's fault. That happens. That's very clear in so many of these cases.
Well, that's the date rape phenomenon, yeah.
Yeah, but that's not the date rape phenomenon. The date rape phenomenon that I understand is where the guy puts some drugs.
Oh yeah, but I'm saying that the woman will use that. The woman will exploit the understanding that the male is the initiator, the stronger.
I actually got involved in one of those cases just by overhearing at a university, a school that I taught at. And I just happened to be working in my office on a weekend. Because I would do that. I would go in, I would either work on papers or I would do research and things like that. And I was in there I heard a pair of students, and I recognized one of the voices for certain who was in my class, one of my classes. And I was pretty sure I recognized the other voice. And the conversation essentially went this way. The one I recognized said that she had been out with a guy a couple of days ago, and they'd gone to bed, and he had never called her back.
Yeah.
And that she had get him, and she would file on him. And so it a few weeks later, I found out that there was a formal complaint and a rape charge filed with the police, and of course the necessary proceedings on the campus. And so I went down to the police department, and I explained to them what I had overheard. And then I went back to the campus, and I had them convene the committee, and they brought her in and with the guy, and she made her complaint, and her friend was there. And then I told them what I had heard and where I'd heard it and when I'd been there, and she turned chalk white. She knew, and they knew. But there are times when it's real. Mm-hmm. There's times when drugs like ecstasy are used, and in that case, I think the best solution would be for a couple of guys to administer what we would call in the Marines summary punishment, and deal with it. I mean, that is a crime, using drugs to get any kind of an advantage for anything.
Mm-hmm.
But simply not calling a girl back, well, maybe she wasn't any good. Maybe you didn't like her. Maybe you like someone else better. All of these possibilities.
Yeah, or she's dealing, that's how she's dealing with the guilt of her actions.
There's differences on that. Just to dislike someone isn't a basis for destroying a guy's future and his career, with a false rape allegation.
Mm-hmm. And this is why you suppose you have presumption of innocence and due process.
Women will do it in a heartbeat. Women will do it in a heartbeat.
Well, I mean, look at divorce proceedings when there's a separation. It's almost routine that there are false accusations of sexual abuse of the children. I know a
Yeah.
couple cases personally where false accusations were made knowingly, and the court knows this too. They wink and nod at it, and they just consider this is par for the course. And this is done under oath in many cases, but it's done as a leverage
And it doesn't help at all that something over 80% of family court judges are women.
Yes, and the fact
Doesn't
that
help at
yeah,
all.
and
I don't know if you saw it. There was a documentary. Oh, must have been made 18, 20 years ago now. It was, and I think it was called Red Pill.
yes.
It was by a woman who had self-declared herself a feminist, and she was looking at the men's rights movement, I think it was, or something like that. And I watched that, and I noticed that at the end of it, when she says, "Well, I don't know what I am right now, but I know I'm no longer a feminist." And that was an honest, oh, she got so much crap,
Yes, yeah.
so much blowback for that, but it was absolutely true. She told the truth, and you're not supposed to do that. It's like I said to someone, and in fact, I quoted in the article, it was a folk song sung by Judy Collins. I don't know who wrote it. An old folk singer of my generation. You're a good deal younger than me, so you came well after that.
Oh, I remember Judy
But
Collins, yes.
the song went, men are born to die in honor, women born to stay alive.
Yeah, that's a qu quite a difference.
It's an enormous thing, but if you're in the military, you can't think that way. You really can't. I mean, the Marines are perhaps a little more aggressive and more, or they were. I they are they're changing dramatically under the current administration, and not for the better. But traditionally, the Marines, I think, were much more of a very old-fashioned military organization. And when you can't think that way and go into battle, you can't. Because if you do think that way, you won't fight. You really won't, because fighting involves the very clear risk of death. Now, some women can do it. I have run into a couple of female fighter pilots, one Air Force, one Navy, who were as bloodthirsty as any fighter pilot you've ever run into. But that's a different thing than being in a ground combat arm. If you're a pilot, it doesn't matter if you're an NFL linebacker. That plane's engines go out, your plane is going down. That's the end of it. It's a matter of reflexes, vision, visual acuity, hand and eye coordination, skill as a pilot. These are all things where women really can excel. They really can. Smaller body, lighter weight, better resistance to G stress than men do. I don't know. Could I give birth? I don't think so. Could I go through 12 hours of labor? Not on this earth. Even if it were physically possible, I wouldn't do it. Even the fact of doing, even the process of doing it, involves a degree of endurance at that type of a situation that is extremely difficult for men to contemplate. But women can do that. They do it. That's how they give birth. And traditionally, that's how they really gave birth, and that's why they had a 50% death rate in childbirth.
This speaks to the
Now,
complementary nature of men and women,
yeah,
not the
exactly.
competitive relation, the complementary.
Exactly.
Yes.
But if you're talking about the other part of it, to stand and take the volley from the other side, thinking about our Civil War, or to walk into the guns at Iwo Jima or Normandy, that's not something women in our military have ever had to do, or women in any modern military have ever had to do. It's been a very low intensity conflict situation compared to what World War I or World War II or Korea or even Vietnam was.
Well, even the essential of camaraderie, which relies on essential male bonding and the sense of male shame, which wouldn't have, women wouldn't have.
It's more, it's not, it's more than that. If you had women, I thought about this. If you had had women in my platoon, had one or two women in my platoon, there are only two possibilities, both of which are destructive of morale and unit cohesion. One is that they're going to have an affair, they're going to have an affair, they're going to link up with a guy, and every other man is going into combat knowing they might die in the next hour. Is going to be, to say, unhappy and demoralized is an understatement. Or the women are going to be equally promiscuous, and that's going to mess the entire unit cohesion and discipline up too. The only possible way you can do this is by have a single standard of physical fitness for men and women. They both have to do the same thing, no matter what their gender, they have to do the same thing. And second, like the Starship Troopers bit, there has to be roughly equal numbers within a unit, and you pair them up
And
on a rotating schedule.
are they
But
all beautiful? Are they all beautiful women like on Starship Troopers?
it's exactly that way. But it has to be one of those things, or you're going to have a morale and discipline and unit cohesion problem, period.
But the maintaining of standards across the board would exclude most women, wouldn't it?
I mean, and this is why. This is why women are very good as guerrillas, as terrorists, and as assassins, because that's an individual thing that doesn't require the types of unit cohesion and discipline that a regular military unit does. I mean, there were a lot of women in the Viet Cong in Vietnam, in the Vietnamese guerrillas. There really were. And they were very effective because that was the type of thing that they could do best. But in the Viet Cong combat units, the main force battalions, the main force regiments, the ones that actually stood out and slugged it out with Marine and I presume Army units, I was not in the Army, but with Marine and presumably Army units, there were no women.
Now, in terms of politics, and the role of women in society is the traditional idea, and I think the more sensible idea is that women would exert more control over the domicile, and the men who would be charged with protection of the community, the village, the city, the country, if you will, were naturally more inclined to be involved in public affairs because that's their domain, that's their responsibility, and mentally, emotionally, they're more suited to that. Whereas women tend to be more emotive, and therefore more open for manipulation by those who control the public narrative or information, which is why I think the franchise was expanded. Ironically, as the franchise has expanded, the right to vote has expanded in the West, in the United States, government has become more bureaucratic, more technocratic, more secretive. So just expanding the vote, which is,
And also, in the media, that the media have become essentially hissy fits with gossip sessions. That's what they are. That's essentially what they are. And I say that two of my favorite media people, no, it's not Tucker Carlson, it's a black woman, Harrison Faulkner, and Laura Ingraham are both extremely good. I mean, there are others out there. There's a couple of men, but basically, I mean, there's some good women, Faulkner in particular, smart, tough, articulate. I don't know where she came from, but she's really good. But that's a rarity. The interesting thing when you mentioned that we were talking about the home and the village, did you ever see a film called The Last Samurai?
Is that the Tom Cruise one?
You know,
Bits
and
and pieces of it, yeah.
there's a scene in it. There's a scene in it where brother and sister are talking to one another, the Japanese brother and sister, and that they're having an argument, a dispute about what to do about him. And the brother says, "This is my village." He's the village chief, you know. And she looks back at him and said, "This is my house. Like, you control the area between the houses. That's your job. You control the village as a whole. What takes place within the walls of this house, this is my power. This is where I rule." And that's not a bad thing. That is not at all a bad thing.
It recognizes not
they
just the
keep, they each
nature.
have their sphere of power, they each have their sphere of influence. There are areas where they can predominate and do so effectively. You know, no question of that. That doesn't mean that the women couldn't fight, because I didn't realize this until I guess about 10 years ago. But that the women who were of the samurai class were also trained as warriors, but not with the same weapons as the men. Women in ancient Sparta, the same way. They also were trained to fight, to train for physical fitness and fight. You know, gymnos means naked, and a gymnasium is where you exercise naked. Mm-hmm. And the men and women would both do it separately. Mm-hmm. But the men would do it with their heavier weapons, you know, a shield, an 8 to 10 foot spear, armor, a sword. The women would do it with lighter javelins, bows, knives, but they would still fight. And they were the ones who would protect the villages of Sparta. Sparta consisted, I didn't realize this, of seven villages, like Rome was on seven hills. Well, Sparta consisted of seven villages with no wall around them, no wall at all. Only place in Greece that didn't have a wall. Its wall was its people. And when the army was out, the men were out fighting, the women would protect the home, and apparently did so really well.
Yeah.
So it can be done, but it has to be understood very clearly that there are different competencies and different spheres of power and influence, and they don't have to be the same. You don't both have to do the same thing in order to be equal. Equal and equity are not synonymous. Equity is forced equality. Equal means that you have different spheres of influence in which you are independently capable. And that's fine.
Well, even like in the rearing of the family, raising the family, the mother is going to provide something that the father can't, and the father's going to provide something the mother can't, generally speaking. And the mother's
yep,
going
to
unconditional love. She's going to be there to protect. And the child, the father's there to introduce the child to the real world, to
yep.
tell the child the world
and,
really
you
know, is.
I was brought up by a single mother in the 40s and 50s, when it was very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few others, I mean, whose fathers had died in World War II. But, you know, my mother was divorced, and I was sort of treated as a carrier of an infectious disease mm-hmm. by the other mothers, you know, my classmates' mothers. Like, I might have something that's catching, you know, got to watch this. But it's very, very true. I mean, there was an element growing up that I didn't have as a boy, and that for better or for worse, I got in the Marines. And that was a very abrupt change. The good part of it is, if there is a good part, is that I had to start working very young. I had a paper route of 12. I don't know if you know what setting pins in a bowling alley was, but I started added that at 14. And then at 17, I enlisted in the Marines when I graduated from high school. I mean, there must have been white privilege out there. I guess I just missed it somehow.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, I mean, I had to do that on my own. And most of my classmates didn't have to do that. They didn't have to work. I did, because it was essential. And I mean, there weren't two paychecks coming in. I certainly couldn't bring in a paycheck, but I could bring in some money, which helped to put some food on the table. And I did that. That was the best I could do. So I learned that at a very young age. But the downside of it is that when I got introduced to the real world, it was through the prism of the Marine Corps. And there's a lack of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
on my part for other people as a result of that. I mean, someone else can have a hard life in a tough way, and I say, so? You know, I just don't, I don't empathize with that. The empathy button on my in my life just really never developed. Because to go from being a high school boy to a Marine is a pretty abrupt change when you haven't been introduced into adulthood gradually over the process of growing up by a father. And so you tend to be, what was this, one of my French colleagues told me, he said, you're a classic Frank. You know, like we talk about speaking frankly, to be direct or something like that. Well, the Franks were a Germanic tribe who settled in what is now central and northern France. The German word for France is Frankreich, Kingdom of the Franks. And they had a reputation for being blunt and direct past the point of rudeness. and he said, that's you. So apparently my German and Jewish heritage got a shot in the arm from the Marine Corps, and you got the combination of German, Jew, and Marine, and there's not too much kindness and gentleness out there, I'm afraid. And which is probably why I wrote this article and then didn't immediately hide and run for my life. You know.
Well, you point out in the article also is, of course, the increase of the role influence women in politics and in corporations has also coincided with a degradation of society, the breakdown of the social fabric, which is going to happen because women provide the basis for society, the raising of children, providing the home for the children and for the fathers to support the home. And if you disrupt that, you're going to create a lot of problems in society down the road, as we see the consequences of family dissolution. This subjects kids to much higher rates of things like abuse and trauma, which then creates generations of janissaries for the very system that's victimizing these people. It's sort of the evil genius to this system. Then they instrumentalize the victims of their culture war. And this is planned out. I mean, if you're familiar with something like the Jaffe memo, which revealed there was a plan to promote things like sexual confusion, homosexuality through the breakup of the family, because the government's population, the population council, the government, and Planned Parenthood kind of planned this out. It was sort of a psychological warfare. And of course, this coincides with the promotion of the feminist movement, which wasn't a radical dissident movement. It had all the support of the state, of corporations, of the system. In fact, Gloria Steinem herself has been revealed to be a CIA agent, supported by the CIA. So this thing wasn't organic. Ms. Magazine had all the benefit of corporate funding, and so it was all promoted with music and the movies, the women's movement and this stuff, and it all support of all the men in corporate America, because they wanted one thing. They wanted to swell the ranks of the labor pool to lower wages, because they wanted lower wages, right? Yep. Women at home aren't taxable. They're providing immense value, but it's not taxed. It's also, they're providing a situation, a home life, a domestic life, and a community which is less subject to social engineering and manipulation by Hollywood or Madison Avenue or the Pentagon, for that matter, or CIA, for that matter, which are all interrelated, as we know. I mean, these aren't separate entities. They're concentric circles. You have to draw a Venn diagram and understand how the system works. So all this was going on at the time. But we've seen with this promotion of women, the elevation of women in power, you can have it all. You're just the same. You're just as good as men. The degradation of men and particularly white men. And we saw this in media. Yeah. The creation of the stupid father. You know, it started out with the Ward Cleaver or Father Knows Best. Now we have Homer Simpson, right? And Al Bundy. So we've had that same media for the destruction of male authority, which is very destructive. I think you kind of suggested in the article, if I recall, is why would they want to get rid of male authority? Well, they get rid of male authority because if you get rid of the men, there's no one there to protect the women anymore.
Yep. You know? And there's no one to fight you.
Yes, particularly Europeans.
The gullibility factor is simply not there. I mean, if you just think about it, think about the number of magazines and that are there for women's fashions and pushing women's fashions compared to the one for men. Mm-hmm. Or any ads that you see on that, you know, Very, very few for men, for boys and men. Very, very few. Sports Illustrated, not quite the same thing, but you know, it's that. There just are far, far more of this for women. Women will follow fashions, fads, and fantasies far more gullibly than men will. Men have their own weaknesses. We, you know, you and I both know that.
Mm-hmm.
But our weaknesses are largely women.
Pornography, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, which has never really appealed to me. I'm just, you know, like, and if you can't touch it, why care, you know?
Yeah, I never had a compulsion. I mean, obviously, I look at a photograph and I acknowledge the airbrush beauty of it all, but I know it's fake.
Yeah, you know.
No, it's not, you know, and no. or it was an insult to my dignity, too, yeah.
Yeah, I have absolutely no doubt that if it were known that I don't think men have role models in the sense that women do in terms of fashions or their personal behavior. We may have role models in terms of people we idolize, but that's not going to dictate how we behave.
What's weird is
about women.
Emasculated men do, though. Feminized men do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if women believed that some female role models were having sex with dogs, there'd be women buying up male dogs from every kennel in America.
Has to do with status, perhaps, and status indicates an ability to get resources, so it gives out that primal
possibly. I don't
desire
know.
For
I
security. Don't, yeah.
What I say, I know the what. I'm not sure about the why, and the one thing that I've been talking with some of the few female friends who, with paper bags over their heads, will still talk to me. Is how can we filter this so that percentage of women who are good and tough and smart and strong can go into these fields while keeping the large majority of the impressionable, gullible, irresponsible ones out? How do we erect that, get that filter? I don't know. I think that we would be worse off not having somebody like Harrison Faulkner in journalism, like someone like Kristi Noem in politics. But how do we let the Kristi Noems in and keep the Gretchen Whitmers out, or the Lori Lightfoots out? Who's, you know, she's now a professor at Harvard. Yes, she is.
It's so appropriate.
Harvard has its first black woman president.
And she hired
Lori Lightfoot as a professor at Harvard. God help us. No, God won't help us. this would probably incline me to become a Satanist. You know, Satan help us. You're the only one who can at this point.
Well, if you do the polling, I saw a map, electoral map, if only white males voted and it was all red.
Yeah.
Then I saw a map that if only married people voted, men and women, it was still red.
Yep. Yep.
So there's ways you can indirectly improve women's behavior.
If it's only single women who voted,
it's off. Yeah, it's a dystopia, as you write.
Exactly.
And so one thing they've done with the culture war is they've undermined things like traditional marriage and courtship, and also moral subversion, the promoting immorality, and you know, any as John Adams said, that our republic, our constitution, cannot operate outside the existence or the of a moral people. And if you promote immoralities, or the state, corporate America, Hollywood is in the business of promoting immorality, Satanism, Luciferianism, if you will, we see today that's this out, it's like exposed now. The system cannot function because it relies on, any system relies on moral people, and you can't promote immorality, expect the system to continue functioning. We're seeing a breakdown in that. So if you were to well, one of the things is acknowledging who's doing it.
One of the interesting comments that I heard, or rather that I read, sorry. Remember, I've been up since 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. I'm just, you know, at 81 years of age, I am starting to fade. You know, imagine a Weimar Republic where the Frankfurt School had won, and that had 15% of its population Africans, African immigrants. That's America. That's America. And what, it was one of those cool things. Well, Weimar problems require Weimar solutions, and they really do. And there's such that my next piece, is going to be done on Tuesday, or it's going to be done on Monday and hopefully published on Tuesday, and it's going to be the last of a series of several articles I've done on America's Endgame. And it's called America on the Abyss, a Manifesto for the Militia. And it's not a how-to on how to build IEDs or store food or stuff like that. It's a function. It's on politics and strategy. But we can't survive this way. We simply cannot survive. There is nothing in the current situation, much less what's going to happen in the next couple of years, to preserve anything of the American constitutional order or the republic, which is largely gone anyway. So how do we restore? The Constitution was based on the premise of a union of sovereign states with a limited franchise. That was it. The more you got away from a union of sovereign states with a limited franchise, the more you got away from the premise of the Constitution, and the less relevant the Constitution was as a mechanism of governance. And one of the things that this article on the feminine dystopia, not the feminist dystopia, of course, but the feminine dystopia, which made me even more enemies, was that because of this, largely because of this, we need to understand that we can't save everything and still have a republic. One of the classics in military tactics and strategy, if you try and defend everything, you end up defending nothing. Well, the corollary of that, if you try and save or restore everything, you're going to end up saving or restoring nothing. You have to decide what you can dispense with and what you can preserve. And that's what the second piece, the next article is looking at. What can we preserve? And one of the things we can't preserve is the type of a franchise, the type of female suffrage that allows women to do again what they have done to us now. Period.
There were anti-suffragists, by the way.
Oh, there were. I know.
And
Absolutely.
everything
Absolutely.
they warned of, they've been vindicated.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of my grandmothers was very much of that. She was
Well, they
absolutely
understood. I
opposed
mean,
to it.
if you look at campaign literature, such as existed prior to women getting the franchise, it still appealed to women, meaning that the woman would influence her husband, and the husband
Oh,
represented the
absolutely.
family.
Absolutely.
That's a limited franchise that's functional because it's rational, it's mediated, and it's deliberate. It isn't emotional. It isn't
Exactly.
this mass
Exactly.
democracy, mail-in voting. Gee, what a,
Jesus.
I mean, it's like no chain of
And
custody or
no
anything.
one sat down and asked, well, how is it that even during this false pandemic, that a country the size of India was able to have same-day voting without mail-in balloting or anything like that, with 1.4 billion people,
And not just the voting, because Time Magazine, that February, I think it was February 20, publishes an article how the election was saved, secured, meaning that there is some sort of objective, a Biden victory, and they boast how organized labor corporations and media got together to control the narrative, control the flow of information. So even if you even think voting is genuine or legitimate, the information getting to the voters is being manipulated,
Absolutely. The thing that we're going to have to understand, and I think that it's after the 2022 election, I think it's gradually seeping into the public consciousness, even without the ability to influence the media narrative, is that we are simply not going to be able to vote, legislate, or adjudicate ourselves out of this situation. It's not possible.
No. Yeah, even if you buy in the fact that voting matters, which is, at least at the federal level, is a dubious claim, if democracy gives us, sex reassignment surgery for minors and transgender, drag queen story hour and these things, then democracy be damned. Then.
Look. It's fair. It's absolutely clear that if anyone had done any of these things in the 1960s, they would have been nailed to the goddamn doors of their offices.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's possibly not that dramatically. I think the men in that area, to the applause of their women, would have beaten them to bloody pulps right on the spot. Not even any questions about it. Wouldn't have been an if, and, or buts. I mean, that's not my generation. That would have been my father's generation, but my generation too.
But these are people growing up largely in intact families, or at least at the very least had a notion of an intact family, what the ideal was, because most people had the benefit of intact families. That nuclear intact family was purposely destroyed in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Yep.
That's the authoritarian personality. That's the American Jewish Committee. This was a strategy in the post-war era, because according to the Frankfurt School and these yep. radicals, they're Jewish, and the traditional family, as understood with a patriarchal male authority figure and a nurturing mother, produces fascist, or at least is a seedbed for fascism, and that has to be destroyed. And the only way you get rid of fascism, as they understand it, the F scale yep. and all that stuff. Remember, these are all words they throw out.
Right.
Is to create moral confusion and anarchy, and that way society is easy to manipulate, and especially if you have mass immigration, which has been promoted since 1965.
Well, there is absolutely no doubt that orchestrated depravity and perversion are tools for the destruction of a society, a culture, and a race. There's absolutely no doubt about it.
You didn't mean to put a stop to it. Women are not going to put a stop to this.
No. Tim, a question for you. How old are you?
56.
50. Okay, so you're closer to me than I thought. You sound younger. So you're a generation back, roughly a generation back. Your generation would probably still have had the same attitude as mine. It was the next one after you, the one after you that started really coming apart.
Yeah, and also there was sort of a reaction. I came out of age in the 80s, and that was sort of the Reagan conservative reaction to the 60s.
Yep, exactly. That was sort of the last hurrah of the white male, I think. It may very well have been that. I don't know if we're going to be able to recover this.
Not under the current political.
I've got your email address. I'm going to send you a draft of the next article.
Mm-hmm.
If I manage to get it done before I wrap it up and send it in for publication, and I'd appreciate a very quick response to it. I mean, just read it. Take half an hour to read it through, and then either drop me an email or give me a call or something like that.
Sure.
I'd like your impression. You're just enough younger than I am that you would have a better insight into the next generation, because I don't. You know, I understand very clearly what my generation felt, and I've got a pretty good idea of what your generation felt because you were the undergraduates that I taught when I finished graduate school. But the next generation back is getting more distant, you know, and the one in their 20s, although it's not entirely a lost cause, but it's terra incognita to me. The good news, and this was something I got an invited talk back and an invitation rather, excuse me, my voice is not that great. I mean, believe me, being an octogenarian does matter sometimes, but I was invited to give a talk back in Lansing, Michigan, well, East Lansing, Michigan. I got the invitation in November, and the guy who called me said, you know, it's a small business group, usually about 100 people. He said, you probably never heard of Lansing. And I said, au contraire, I am from Lansing. I graduated from Sexton High School. We went through it. He said, my God, you know where it is? Oh, yeah, you know, like that. So I went back there. And in the process, he's a Greek-American. He's an American of Greek ancestry. That's a better way of putting it. His mother and father were both Greek. His youngest daughter, I guess she's probably 17, 18. They're mostly homeschooled. And he showed me a picture of a senior prom for homeschoolers, almost 300 people, just in Okemos, Michigan, Okemos and East Lansing, Michigan, just the suburbs of Lansing. His youngest daughter is probably 17, 18, either just finished her high school diploma this spring or is going to finish it next spring. I'm not sure what. Down to earth, tough young woman, not screwing around with college, working in business. I met another young woman there, 21 years old. She and her father work a 160-acre farm. She's got 40 acres to herself, dozen head of cattle, chickens. She takes care of everything, rebuilds tractor motors, which I can't do. You know, not been to college, smart, tough. You know, there are some out there. They're a minority in the millennial generation, but there are some out there. I didn't see any men that I would put in that category. It's the women who are strong now in that generation. I don't know what your experience is, but I'd be curious.
Well, I have four sons, and I'm trying to raise them, you know, and give them a sense that they have a responsibility. Well, it's, you know, it's called servant leadership. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's an awesome responsibility. It isn't to lord over somebody. It's to provide leadership and guidance. And most women, if offered that, will many of them will find it appealing and they'll conform to it. And a lot of women, usually the woman will conform to the views of the man if he provides leadership. And if those, you know, views are reasonable, you know.
Yeah, but he has to provide leadership. And I think that's why. You know, and I was talking to these two younger women, well, the 21-year-old in particular, and you know, it was very clear. You know, it was very clear. I said, I'm curious. You know, you're attractive, you're smart, you're hardworking. Why aren't you married? She said, I'm picky. Very picky, and you know. A woman in her 50s and another one in her 60s that I talked with afterwards, and they said, yeah, she's not alone. It's, you know, it's basically a German, Polish, Greek community and a farming community in that part of Michigan, which still is pretty much intact. And then she said, not at all unusual here. There's lots of people, both young. She said, you didn't happen to meet any young men who've had that attitude because they're working on their farms, you know. they're out there working now, you know. The women are taking a couple of hours out to come into this, and they'll talk to them about what they did. And I looked around at the audience, and there weren't many young men in their 20s there. In their 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, yes, but not in their 20s. They were out working. And that's perfectly fine with me. You know, that's
well, because a young man,
that's the normal way that we did things, you know.
Yeah, if you ask me about advice, the young man is anxiety about meeting a girl is, well, get your life in order and the women will show up because you'll attract them. And that's how you attract them. That's how you attract a woman, get your life in order. And you know, women will sense stability and sobriety and maturity if she's well attuned to that.
I think that stability and maturity, the sobriety, it depends. If they're Irish, as I was told, sobriety. I had an Irish priest tell me that sobriety for an Irishman were those interludes between enjoying yourself.
But one thing that a society does face, we see throughout any country. And this is just something that you have to, even women who aren't feminists have internalized feminist views. That's kind of the air where it's the water, you know, the stream that we swim in, the air that we breathe. And so these presuppositions, like having to go to college, have a career, and being just as, you know, being equal in these things. And many women kind of well, they have a misunderstanding about that, and it kind of creates a lot of, well, it creates a lot of heartache and a lot of frustration because they're competing with the man as opposed to being complementary. But if you're going to have a society that stresses things like education and work with women, you're going to have a population crisis because they're not going to be having children.
Well, there's also an interesting paradox here, and it just occurred to me that if you give women full rein to do to enter men's fields,
mm-hmm.
areas that were men, they will lose respect for the men.
Mm-hmm.
They do. You know, they, whether they can do the job as well as men or not is almost irrelevant. I think that they will. Well, I have had a preference in my life for strong, tough women. And if they happen to be good looking, that's fine. That's a bonus, but that's not the primary thing. And a woman asked me once, why do you think that way? I said, if life always goes well, if there are no bumps in the road of life, then fine. A bimbo might be great. that's fine. I just told her, I said, a bimbo might be great. I said, but the road of life always has bumps.
Mm-hmm.
It always has potholes. You're always going to run into problems. And if you have something like that and you've got a bimbo or just an attractive looking airhead on your arm, they're going to run for it and look for someone else. If you've got a strong, tough woman, there's still a chance she'll do it. There's a hell of a lot better chance she'll dig in her heels and help you fight back.
Yes.
And take that. It's going to mean a more contentious life. It's going to mean you can't do the Lord and Master bit, but you can be a leader and a guide without playing Lord and Master.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that as well as I can. It takes a little more work, but it's worth it, I think, in the end. It absolutely is worth it. There is no question whatsoever, but it's worth it.
It's
just that you got to be that young woman's word is a very good one. You got to be picky.
Well, is societal collapse worth tolerating female participation in these things?
Is what?
Is societal collapse a price we're willing to pay just to permit female participation in
absolutely
these?
Not. I would say absolutely not. But no one saw that in the first generation of it. The first generation when this became this would be in the 60s and 70s. I don't mm-hmm. think any one of us saw it.
Well, you see the demographic problems, the birth rates.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the demographics are just absolutely controlling. You know, it's a double-edged sword. On the first hand, you're told that because of overpopulation, you have to stop having kids. And then as soon as you stop having kids, you're told that because of a labor shortage, you've got to import migrants.
Yes. And then our Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, says that abortion is good because it allows women to work more, and that's good for the GDP.
You know, at that point, you understand that I understand what a German friend of mine told me. She said once that this was back in the 80s. She said, you know, and this is when we both understood that the Holocaust was a total hoax, that the Holocaust story was an absolute hoax. You know, she said, you know, the only thing wrong with the Holocaust story is that it didn't happen. That from a German woman, you know. These days, it would be a crime to say that.
In many states, yes.
Germany, and also in many American states.
Yeah.
You know, I'd say, you know, you got to understand that, you know, any people that have done so many bad things that they have to criminalize criticizing them, you got to understand that there's something wrong there.
Yeah, and maybe we're getting at what's causing, obviously, feminism along with a lot of other things like abortion and gay rights would not have been possible without the Jewish role in this.
Organized. I know, absolutely, absolutely.
In fact, the American Jewish Committee just published last May was Jewish Heritage American Month, and they had some gal there, Jewish gal, bragging about the Jewish role in promoting things like gay rights, transgender rights, women in the military, abortion. so on and so on and so on, you know.
Yeah, I know.
And so they admit to it, you know.
Well, not only admit to it, they're not even taking any pains at all to conceal it now.
No.
But you know, it's really an all or nothing thing. They've gone for broke on this, more so than they ever did in Weimar Germany. It was sort of like Weimar Germany was a warm up, and they looked at it and said, "That was close. We almost got really hurt badly in that." So they did it a little more subtly over here. They took control of the institutions that they had to take control of to dominate the narrative. They took control of the media and of education. That was the first things.
Long March, yeah.
Second thing, they went and they took care of law and academe, higher education. And third, they went out for the corporations, particularly the media corporations. And when they got all of that taken together, then the genie came out of the box. Then and only then. You know, basically what happened in Weimar Germany was premature. You know, they went public with homosexuality, transgenderism, all the rest of this before they had complete control of the systems of information and education. And they were fortunate enough that they had enough influence in the US and other countries that they were able to use us to destroy their enemy. You know, I think, you know, I, when I when I when I read that quote by Patton, he was in a letter to a friend of his, an army major general who was back in the States, and obviously people were reading his mail. I mean, which meant that to read the mail of a four-star general meant that they had to have really considerable power. But he basically said, you know, we fought the wrong enemy. He said, we made a mistake. We fought alongside the communists to destroy Germany. We should have fought alongside Germany to destroy the communists. He said that in his letter.
Is that
He
right?
said
Just
it was that I'm summarizing it, by the way. It was a much longer statement. It was about a long paragraph with about a dozen sentences, but that was the bottom line of it. That's what it meant.
it's just before his
And
accident.
yeah, right. You know, and then he had his accident. You know, something like that. You know, it's not just how would you accidentally kill a four-star general? Very carefully, very carefully. You know, particularly a guy who's very popular with his troops. You know, because if you try to kill him and you miss, you know, a guy who's sitting on top of several armored divisions might do unpleasant things to you. You have to be very careful about that. But it was really interesting that, you know, and Patton was not one of these guys, you know, who could be easily bought or persuaded. What I didn't know is that he was the richest man in the U.S. Army at the time.
He was independently wealthy.
Oh
Yeah.
yeah, no question at all. And you know, I'm sure you've heard of this statement, or you may not have actually. You know, Smedley Butler was a Marine Major General, one of five people to win two Medals of Honor, by the way, in our history. Well, after he got out of the Marines, he wrote a small book and actually a pamphlet called War is a Racket. And basically he said that he'd spent his career and his life, you know, as a hired muscle for big business, and that he could give Al Capone lessons, you know, if he wanted to. You
Yeah.
know, what I didn't know until I did some back, I mean, I knew about Smedley Butler's, you know, when I was a young Marine, you know, a guy with, there were two people that they always talked about to new Marine recruits, Smedley Butler, two Medals of Honor. There was a couple of other Marines who had two Medals of Honor. Dan Daly was one of them, and we knew about that. And a guy named Chesty Puller from Virginia, who had five Navy crosses, which is pretty much of a record, I think. But I didn't know that Butler, at the time he was in the Marines as a major general, he was from an old main Philadelphia mainline family and was the richest man in the Marine Corps at the time. That was interesting. And I thought about that comparing him to Pat, and I thought, here you've got these two rich guys. They have everything the system can give them, and they look at the system and they say, bad. These aren't guys who are saying bad because they don't have anything, because they've lost everything, because they're at the bottom of the heap and they're looking up and they're saying, I want something. These are guys who had everything, and they had the honors and the rank and the reputation and the perquisites and the family and the wealth, everything that they could want. Dear God, I would love to have had just now. That's white privilege, let me tell you. But they were also the harshest critics of the system because they had the independent wealth to say it and not worry about what was done to it. Well, that's not quite true. Patton died. I don't think anyone would have. I think if anyone had offed Smedley Butler, the Marine Corps would have found out who did it, and there would have been some bodies floating down the river. It's no
Well,
question at all.
it's very, very, very similar to like James Forrestal, who was another wealthy man
Oh,
who was saying things. Yeah.
First Secretary of Defense, Secretary of the Navy before that, committed suicide by throwing himself out of a window at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Sure, absolutely, I believe that. It's like the guy who had four bullets in the back of his head and it was ruled a suicide. Sure, got it, it's what's unbelievable. And I think that article just touched on an aspect of it, is the degree to which a small number of people have been able to leverage the American system for the achievement of goals that the bulk of the American people would have hanged them at the beginning if they had known of it.
Well, it was key to controlling the media and the narrative
Yep,
and
absolutely,
education. So that, yeah.
absolutely. I mean, I was thinking that, and then you probably know these names too, given your age. If Chet Huntley and David Brinkley and Eric Severide, and the rest of that group of the media greats in the late 60s and 70s were around today, the Hunter Biden laptop story would be on the front page and on every morning show and every evening news hour, and would be out there. And Biden, first of all, Biden wouldn't be president. The 2020 election would never have happened the way it did. And I'm not as I just wrote in the article I finished today, I'm not a never Trumper. I'm not a Trump supporter. I think Trump's instincts were basically good, but I think he was very much out of his depth. He never got control of the government. And I keep thinking about something that Ronald Reagan was quoted as saying. He said that there's only three jobs that prepare a man, said he, please, not a person, a man, to be president of the United States, governor of California, governor of Texas, and governor of New York, because these are the three states that are large enough, populous enough, and complex enough that being governor of one of those states for 8 years prepares a person to go into the White House, and nothing else does. And I think that was a very astute statement.
Yeah, and also people like Trump are beholden, to Jewish power.
Yep.
And
Oh, yeah.
unless you could, right now, I think the primary political question right now for the United States, for the West, for the world, is reining in and holding Jewish power accountable, and bringing it down to size because it's destructive if it's unchecked.
You can't do that unless you destroy Israel, and that should be the first topic on an agenda.
But the Americans, apparently the sovereignty of Israel is more important than to the U.S. government, the protection and sovereignty of Israel is more important than the protection and sovereignty of the United States.
Yes, of course. Well, look at the American government.
Well,
I mean,
yes.
it's basically a Jewish government.
Yeah,
Except,
the intel's full, high tech's full of Unit 182 agents, and the
Yep.
government's full of admitted Zionists.
Right, and it was the same with Trump's administration. No
Yes.
question at all about that. And it would be the same with Trump's administration if he came back. It would be the same with DeSantis. DeSantis went to Israel to sign a law in Florida outlawing anti-Semitism. Huh?
The fact that he wouldn't be even care about the how that looks says so much.
Oh, doesn't it? Absolutely,
I mean, what is that? I
absolutely.
mean, then the White House has a national strategy to combat anti-Semitism, as if that's a problem in the United States. If anything, the problem is the opposite. Philo-Semitism is the
Well,
problem.
it actually is in one sense. If anti-Semitism is defined as the new anti-Semitism, which came up in the late 1970s, there's an article in Commentary magazine in 78 or 79, something like that. And it described the new anti-Semitism as any criticism of Israel, its leaders, its policies, its actions, or its supporters. So if Israeli troops kill a 21-year-old Palestinian nurse, shoot her in the back, and blow her breast off, you can't criticize it. Even mentioning it is anti-Semitic.
Well, that's the problem with it. Any criticism of Jewish power or Jewish individual, Jewish power is considered anti-Semitic. Therefore, they can't be criticized. Therefore, they're supreme.
Yep.
You know, a good example is something, take something like the ADL, which was created to cover up the crimes of a Jewish criminal, Leo Frank. And what was so revealing about the Leo Frank is wasn't Leo Frank's crime, their killing and raping of that young girl. It's the fact that at the time the organized Jewish community, the national, particularly New York, closed ranks around Leo Frank instead of making him be held accountable for his crime. That speaks so much about the Jewish community. Even though they knew he was a criminal, I think it was, what was his name? Andrew Lasker, who was the head of advertising, very key because advertising, he controlled revenue for the newspapers. And they brought Adolf Ochs aboard, the New York Times, owner of the Times. They hated Leo Frank, but what mattered more was the fact that Leo Frank was the head of the local chapter of B'nai B'rith. He was Jewish. And Mary Fagan was just a little Goyim girl. It didn't matter. You know.
I don't know if you know the background of that case, that the person that the Jewish community tried to pin it on was a black guy. You know, now this was in Georgia.
Yeah, Tom Connolly, I think was his name. Or
yeah,
something. Yeah.
This was in Georgia. You know, which was not exactly a woke
yes.
supporter of civil rights. You know, you would have thought that in Georgia at that time, you know, a century ago, that they might or might not have liked Jews. I mean, you know, that they had a Jewish Secretary of War for the Confederacy.
Yeah, I think the South is more philo-Semitic than the North.
Yeah, exactly.
More prominent Jews in the
but,
South
you know,
than the North.
They looked at that. They looked at the two people and said, "Nah, it's Leo Frank." You know, if that had happened in Michigan or New York, you would have said, "Wow, you know that." Might not be surprising that they chose not to condemn a black guy to death. But if you're talking about Georgia at that time, you know, come
they,
on, guy.
They
you know,
suborn
years ago.
There are like 27 or 30 different appeals that they paid. They spent like $25 million at the time on this case.
Yeah.
And they suborned they actually bought perjury. They committed crimes to get him off the hook. And when the governor, I think Slayton was the time, who was bribed to commute his sentence, that's when he was lynched.
Yep, I know. And you know, it was a mixed black and white mob that did it, by the way.
Yeah,
and I saw a picture of it in the local I think it was the Atlanta Constitution at the time. I don't think they had color photos in those days. There was a black and white photo of it, but you could tell white faces and black faces in the crowd underneath the body. You know, there's no
well,
question
and
at
to
all.
This day, to this day, they're still trying to clear Leo Frank's. They make movies about his innocence, and they've never given up on that.
They're probably going to show that he was a distant cousin of Anne Frank, but he lost his ballpoint pen.
Yes, yeah. I mean, as you say, the destruction of the social fabric, the decline of American culture, the political crisis that we're facing in the country, coincides with the growth and influence or role of women in politics and public affairs. So it hasn't been an improvement. You can also say that the degradation, decline of America also coincides with the rise of Jewish power.
Yep, exactly. And the two are linked in this case. The two are very clearly linked. I think that the Jewish powers that be understood that as long as white males were the dominant force in American politics, there was a ceiling, a glass ceiling they could not break, where beneath which they had a lot of influence and certainly a great deal of influence. But in terms of formal political power, they couldn't break that ceiling. And there of course, is a difference between influence and power. I mean, influence isn't quite as certain as power. But so they had to break that ceiling. And I think they saw that the way to break that ceiling was to use women not simply to break the glass ceiling for women, you know, in business and corporations and academia and the rest of it, but to use them to break the glass ceiling over Jewish power, to give them access to the entire American system. And they did it successfully.
Well, the American system is very vulnerable to that infiltration because it presumes under liberalism, it says what matters is that we are loyal to certain political ideals or creeds, and our ethnicity, our background doesn't matter. But that isn't really the reality of the situation, is it?
No. Well, it was in a certain sense, because I think that for most of us who were immigrants from Europe, or the descendants of immigrants from Europe, at least into the early 20th century, and I'm not sure about after that, ethnicity was something, and I wrote an article on this for Mondo Weiss, by the way, after I started writing in about 13, 14 years ago again, that ethnicity was something that you expressed in social and cultural terms. I mean, the Irish were probably as strong and cohesive a group as you can imagine. And they certainly wanted a united Ireland, an independent Ireland, no British control, and a united Ireland. But they sure also didn't lobby the United States government to join Germany in its war against Britain.
No.
That was the big difference on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the German community in America was very strong and cohesive, and it had its Oktoberfests. They have an Oktoberfest down here in Mississippi, in Gluckstadt, which is a little town about 12 miles north of Jackson, where I'm sitting now. Every late September, early October, they have an Oktoberfest, which looks like a Munich in miniature. But that didn't translate into a political dimension. And the same with everyone else. We suspected the Japanese in America of doing it, but only a handful during World War II, but only a handful actually back Japan mm-hmm. as a country. But with Jews, there's a minority that are actively in support of Israel, but the majority is at least silent supporters.
Mm-hmm.
That's very clear. And it goes outside of the United States, outside of the political process. And that is unique.
Well, isn't like the top 8 donors to the Republican Party are Jews, and the top 10 donors to the Democratic Party are Jews?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And yeah, here's the difference.
And the leaders of most of the feminist groups are.
Yes.
The leader of one of the two teachers unions in the United States is a radical Jewish woman.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is a radical black woman.
Yeah, and for the most part, civil rights blacks are they're golems of Jewish power.
Exactly.
They rely on
exactly.
Jewish power, and they exhibit the same a similar sort of solipsism and attitude, but you know that their Jewish patrons provide for them. It's similar.
Yep.
Same with the homosexual, organized homosexual groups and all that. The same model, if you will, the civil rights model, which again was mobilized by Jewish power, exploiting a real grievance, real problems, but for the purposes of expanding Jewish power and destroying, the heritage America, European white America, because they saw it as a problem, and as we've laid out.
Well, there's a number of things that we can do to counter this, or to try to counter, and I'm exploring some of them in the next article, and I'll make sure you get a copy of it.
Excellent.
And send you a link to it.
Well, Dr. Sobroski, I think kind of recovered it. Women to return to hearth and home, have a family, raise their children, because that's really, I mean, babies speak their mother's tongue.
Yep.
That's the influence there, and reject the appeals to vanity of power, having it all, and these things. And men, be men, and that's easier said than done, because all the media, all the higher institutions are at war with that, and they're destroying not just the environmental, not just the toxic environment, culture, literal toxins, from what I understand, are at war with masculinity, with the declining sperm counts and all that. So we got a lot. There's a lot of problems there, a lot to deal with here. And of course, but I told you I'd have you for an hour and a half, and I think we're coming up on that now.
Okay, I think so, yeah.
And like I said, you've gone through a marathon of interviews in recent days. So I really appreciate you spending time with me tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. It was a real pleasure. I enjoyed it tremendously on it, and I hope that we have a chance to chat. Doesn't have to be in a formal sense like this, but I think this is a good contact, and I'm glad I met you. I'm truly glad you reached out to me, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk, and I'm glad we had a chance to meet, and I'm going to definitely keep this connection going as long as I can.
Thank you. And we tried to explain our position. And unless my wife, my wife hears listens to this conversation. I've made my views clear, and that she understands me, I
If I hear a
think.
shriek in the background, I'll know what's happening.
Is we're not saying that women are not important. We're saying they're very important. Matter of fact,
And that's the point. You know, it's like
they're uniquely important.
a good way of ending it and thinking about this is to remember that scene from The Last Samurai, when the brother and sister are talking, and the brother says, "This is my village," and the sister doesn't bat an eye and give an inch, and she says, "This is my house." In other words, you've got your power, I've got mine. Don't intrude on mine. And that's it. And I don't have any problem with that in the slightest. I don't have any problem with that in the slightest. You know, it's there's a reason that for thousands of years that has been the bedrock of society. That doesn't exist across hundreds of cultures and dozens of centuries.
And pretty
That's the
much it's a
bedrock of
universal,
society.
and pretty much for what I understand, historically, universally, when that balance has been upset, you have civilization collapse, right? I mean.
Well, you know, that there was a one of the people who made a comment on that article put up a book by someone called Unwin. He was a don at one of the colleges at Oxford University in the 1930s, and he had a book on called which he wrote and published in 1934 called Sex and Cultures, and he had studied literally hundreds of cultures over thousands of years. He found that in each and every case where women achieved sexual freedom and political power, the civilization collapsed in 3 to 4 generations. Now, the irony of this is that 2 years after he published this book, he died at the age of 41. And I just wonder which proto-feminist got him.
So, yeah, it's 'cause well, yeah, like 'cause sexual liberation or freedom, well, I think E. Michael Jones has spelled it, well, that's actually political control, so. And so, well, listen, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Tim. Do you prefer Tim or Timothy?
Tim's fine.
Okay, Tim. Really good to meet you. Enjoyed it. I'll send you a link to that next article when it comes. I'll send you a link to this one when it's out. Well, you've got one of them, and we've got the Uns Review one. I'll send you a link to the next one when it comes out, and I'll try and get you an advanced copy for comments. But I'm pushing to get it done so it can be published on July 4th. Not coincidentally, it being Independence Day. And I'll let you know when it comes out.
That used to be a big holiday, right?
Ah, it used to be, yeah. It was the day after Gettysburg.
That's right. So, good night then. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Tim. You take care. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
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 I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend. 'Cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor. You can bend but never break me, 'cause it only serves to make me more determined to achieve my final goal. And I come back even stronger, not an honor.